Well, good. We've got just 50 minutes. And this topic that we're going to be talking about is so vast that we cannot comprehensively cover it in 50 minutes. I remember and have remembered the development of the understanding of immunization. And we used to sit and talk about discoveries and new facts, and we have moved over the last 40 years in the understanding of immunization, so that today there are so many chemicals and so many things. People are getting PhDs studying tiny, tiny portions of the immune system. So what is the immune system? The immune system refers a little bit more specifically to a role played by special elements of the blood. Dr. Landless talked about skin, how that is a protective barrier. In our saliva, there are enzymes that may kill bacteria. In our tears, there are enzymes that may kill bacteria. But the immune system that I'm going to talk about today has a lot to do with what we call humoral and cellular immunity. So the objectives here are to affirm an understanding of cellular immunity and to affirm our understanding of humoral immunity and to give or affirm a basis for immunization. So I'm narrowing down to the very specific areas of immunity. First of all, we have to understand the white blood cell. The white blood cell is key to this type of immunity. Now, if you take 10 cc's of blood, put it in a test tube, spin it around in a centrifuge, maybe an old-fashioned hand-driven one if you're in a mission hospital, or an electric one if you're sitting you centrifuge the blood, and you centrifuge it enough, you will find that about maybe 40% of the test tube is packed down to red blood cells. On top of it, there will be a very thin layer like the cream on milk, narrower than the cream on milk, but that is called the buffy coat. It is the white blood cells that have packed down on top of that. And then above it would be a yellow fluid, which is about 45%, half the blood, and that is plasma, the liquid, which contains proteins and other solutes. But the white blood cells that form that buffy coat are what we're talking about. And the white blood cells are many different kinds of white blood cells. But the white blood cells that deal with immunity, they all deal with immunity, but that deal with the cellular immunity are often called granulocytes. If we look at this particular cell here, here are the nuclei, which are the dark, densely staining, basophilic staining, that's called blue thing. Here we see inside the cytoplasm of the cell all kinds of inclusions. These are granules, and we call these granulocytes because of those granules, granular cells. These are packages of enzymes that can be used to kill bacteria. And they do that when they engulf the bacteria. White blood cells are different from each other. There are different functions that the white blood cells have. So although we call them as a group white blood cells, they are not the same at all. They are involved in directly destroying viruses and bacteria, and some of them also produce antibodies. Now, antibodies are protein substances that wrap themselves around foreign proteins or antigens. So these two words, antigens and antibodies, these are very important. An antigen generates a response. And the antibody is that substance that is produced as a response to the antigen. So when a measles virus comes into your body recognizes it, says, aha, and this is a measles virus, and it produces antibodies against that particular virus. when the body's cells are stimulated to produce antibodies, we produce an army of experienced cells. You know, when you go and you look at an army and it goes to war, different factions of the army do different functions. And as they gain experience, they become more efficient. So if the Marines are working, the Marines will go into the territory and they become more efficient as they work that thing. So if you've got a group, a battalion of experienced Marines, they will do better than the inexperienced. So as the cells have met a particular infection, they become experienced by producing, and they can rapidly reproduce and produce more of the particular antibodies. So in other words, the process of immunization is really that of inducing experience to those cells that deal with that particular infection. There are about six main groups of white blood cells. The polymorphic nuclear cell is about 62%. I don't know if I corrected this or not. This was not quite correct. Yeah, I've corrected this. About 62% of the cells are neutrophils. About 2% are what we call eosinophils. About 4% are what we call basophils. Now, you notice there, I'm not saying the polymorphonuclear basophils, the polymorphonuclear neutrophils, the polymorphonuclear. They are all polymorphonuclear. That means that the nucleus, when you look at it, isn't a round ball, but it's sort of segmented. It's got many bodies, and you see the pictures of that. And then we have the basophils, which represent about 4%. Their nucleus is not segmented, but is round. And then we have monocytes, who also have a round nucleus. And then we have lymphocytes and plasma cells, which make about 28%. The lymphocytes and the plasma cells are involved in producing antibodies. The other cells are produced in directly killing either an invading organism such as a virus or a bacteria, and also are involved in killing tumor cells. So when we talk of cellular immunity, we're talking about these cells up here. And when we talk of humoral immunity, we're talking about those there that are producing antibodies, but they both work together, much like the Navy and the Air Force work together, because they are both of them carrying on a function of protecting the body.
Doctor,
yeah.
Those numbers are different than the book.
I know, that's why I said I've corrected. That's that, correct your book, yes. Because they don't add up there to 100% if you look at it. So that's what we did. These are approximations. No biologic system is exactly 62% or something like that. So if you want to go back, you can look at those percentages. It's not ever exactly the way. So, you know, they vary. And when we collect these from different sources, we get one group saying about 4%, another saying about 2%. Well, but when we put them all together, they didn't add up. So I said, hey, let's make this so it's approximately like that. And this is how these are approximately like that. That's why we put approximately up here, okay? So, you know, there's a range of what it may be. Now, macrophages. Macrophages. What does macro mean? Big, yeah, grande. I took my daughter for Italy, and we went there, and I rented a Mazda, and I came up to a ferry in Lake Maggiore. We were going to go take the ferry across the lake, and so I drove up there, and they said, you have to go and get a ticket. So I went to the thing, and I said, what have you got? I said, oh, I got a little Mazda. So she gave me a ticket to go on. When I came to put it off, the man there, he said, this is not a little car. This is a grande car. And so for the rest of the trip, we were saying, we're driving in a grande car, you know? And so we had to pay a little extra to go on the ferry. Grande means macro. What does phage mean? What does phage mean? Macrophage, phage or phage? It eat, yes, phagos, you see. They like to eat. Here's the Greek. He came just in time because he knew that I might have difficulty telling you. So, macrophages are big eaters. See, these guys are the big eaters, and they will swell in tissue, and they are long-lived, and they eat a lot of bacteria. Now, the function of the white cells The monocytes and the granulocytes are involved in eating a bacteria. The lymphocytes, I've already told you, produce antibodies. Platelets are very interesting. They don't really have a direct role in immunization. But platelets, if they are activated, they will cause a transformation in the protein from fibrinogen to fibrin. And when that transformation takes place, the protein, instead of being soluble, it suddenly becomes insoluble and forms a clot. And clotting, platelets play a role in sometimes entrapping bacteria in tissues as part of the process. And certain bacteria stimulate more of that reaction. They have certain enzymes that clot them together. So it's a very extremely complex situation that we're dealing with. If you believe this could have happened by chance, you're out of your, you know, head, because this is just so complex. Now, let's say we have a bacteria. There are various things on the cells. Remember we told you the cell wall, various carbohydrates, maybe the various proteins. These may be seen as the markers, the definers. These are the antigens. These are what stimulate the body to recognize the face. If I look at you, the particular characteristics of your face will help me to recognize you. You're slightly balding. Your eyes go like this way. When I look at his, I see something different. Oh, he's got a mustache. His nose is a little different shape from yours. His chin has got different markings. Oh, look at this one, slightly round. You see, those characteristics of the surface are what make themselves recognizable to the immune cells. And so they find these differences and they identify them. And of course we get lectins or antibodies and things. When they coat that particular characteristic, they enhance the capacity for the cells to eat them. Just like ketchup makes French fries more eatable, so the antibody makes some of these bacteria more eatable. I'm using this just as an example. Now, antibodies look like this. The chemistry of an antibody is amazing. I mean, this to unravel this took years in many laboratories. They talk about the light chains and the heavy chains. You see, the light chains, the heavy chains. Then they had to find out that they were, you know, it was a paired type of immunoglobulin. Then they talk of this is an IgG, but they found that if you get five or six of molecules like this, we have an IgM. You know, all kinds of things have been done. I'm talking just a very overview. But with the overview, you get the idea, you see. Get the idea. So these types of antibodies can be produced in response to the infection. Now, granulocytes, those are the cells that have those granules. So there are the neutrophils, the eosinophils, and remember we talked about the basophilic granulocytes. They will last in the bloodstream about 4 to 6 hours. What do we mean last? Well, they are in constant motion through the body. So they only stay in the bloodstream and they will be replaced, just like the troops in Afghanistan may be deployed in Afghanistan for 3 months, but it doesn't mean that they're not in the army anymore. They come back, they go to Fort Bragg or they go to wherever. So they go back through the tissues. So they may be 4 to 8 hours in the blood, in the blood, but they may be 4 to 5 days in the tissues. And then they eventually die. Now, lymphocytes keep circulating for weeks or months, and some strains, the family of lymphocytes, go for our lifetime. That's why we may have lifetime immunity. So if we get immunity to, say, measles, there will be for the rest of our life a family of lymphocytes that are measles fighters that will live within us for the rest of our life. And should we come across measles again, that family will suddenly burst and there'll be a population explosion of those lymphocytes that are measles killers. So those lymphocytes are going to live with us for the rest of our life. A family, a strain of them, is going to be in our population of lymphocytes. We are fearfully and wonderfully made. Or perhaps the evolutionist is right. It all happened just by chance. Give me a break. You see, if you don't believe there is a God, what other explanation can you possibly come to? They don't understand that evolution is in their thinking because they have denied the possibility of a God. But if you believe in the possibility of God, then it is most logical to say he planned all this. If you don't believe in a God, then you are left straining at gnats and swallowing camels of scientific possibilities. And these are such far gone possibilities. We are just giving you a touch of the trillions of various things that have had to happen, and for them all to have happened coherently, it's chances of one in trillions. That's, of course, why they say, well, it took so many years. It had to take trillions and billions of years for it to take place. They're hoping that by extending the time frame over which it took place, that this was the reason, this will allow for this to have taken place, not realizing that if an event took place a trillion years ago, the chances of that being able to persist like these lymphocytes do in our body with that particular strain for that long, it decreases. So it becomes very, very difficult for isolated mutations taking place in different parts of the world to coalesce and come together. Even if you make it over trillions of years, it's going to be less and less likely that that would happen. But here we are, we're looking at red cells, and there's the white cell. This would be a basophil, big, nice, round nucleus. So you see these cells are mobile. They move. Now, we begin biology often by looking at pond water, and we look down there in the microscope, and we see an amoeba. How many of you have seen an amoeba through the microscope? Yeah, some of you have seen an amoeba. Well, an amoeba moves by sort of flowing. It sort of extends itself, and then it flows into there, and it all fills that portion, and it moves by pseudopodia, we call it. It moves by flowing into these extensions of itself. Against, say, for instance, a paramecium. A paramecium, how many of you have seen a paramecium? Paramecium looks a bit in shape like this thing. It's got a lot of little cilia around it, and the cilia are going brrrr, and it moves like a Viking ship, you know, with the paddles being the cilia, okay? But white blood cells, they have an amoeboid action. They have this amoeboid, they move like the amoeba. And they also can squeeze through little spaces. So they find a little crack and they put a little piece of them in the crack. A little piece goes through the crack and then the rest of them flows. And the little piece on the other side of the crack, it starts to swell up. And here they're on this side of the crack. Now they're getting bigger and bigger. And they've gone through the spaces between the cells. So that's how they get out of the blood vessels into the tissues and through the lymphatics and so forth. And between the tissues, they flow through by diapedesis. All right. Now they are also attracted by chemicals. There are scores and scores of different kinds of chemicals released by cells that will attract these infectious agents. So let's imagine we studied just quickly. I'll leave the tyranny of the PowerPoint, and if we have, oh, we don't seem to have any. Do we don't have pens now today for to draw on here? I was going to. Have you got a? Somebody got a marker or a pen? No, you know, you're writing your notes. Yeah. Well, let's see if it will show up. But, yeah, basically, we have an invasion. No, it's not going to show. But we have the invasion of tissue with a microorganism. This microorganism damages tissues. It has toxins. So the little microorganism, so small we can't see it, yeah, it starts to produce a few toxins. These toxins are going to damage the tissues. And so the tissues, the cells that are around here, we'll draw these like cells like this, these cells, they suddenly say, hey, ouch, oh. How do they shout that? They shout it by releasing chemicals. And the chemicals that are released, they attract these cells. And the cells say, hey, this tissue calling for help there. So immediately there comes in these other cells. Now when the cells come there, they say, hey guys, we're going to need reinforcements. We're in trouble here. So they, these cells, release further chemicals. The chemicals dilate the blood vessels. These chemicals also open the pores between the tissues. So now we're starting to see more blood coming into the area. Now we're starting to see the separation of the cells so that the more fluid can come to the area. And we have begun a process that allows now white blood cells to come there. And if the white blood cells come in the thousands, now the millions, now the trillions, well, now we've got a load of cells, we might have pus starts to form in this particular area because it's the collection of white blood cells. If you take pus, look at it under the microscope, it's just sheets upon sheets of these immune cells. So the inflammatory process, is a protective process that is set in order to destroy these invading microorganisms. And it's a protective mechanism. And all of these things, the calls for help from the cells, the opening of the capillaries so that more blood can come, the opening of the little spaces between so diapedesis can take place, the influx of these cells which release further substances. Hey, send reinforcements, here we are, we're down here in the big toe, we're having trouble, the toenails growing in here, there's bacteria, come along. You know, that's what they're shouting, but they're shouting it in chemical language, you see. And what a coordinated process it is. Now, not only is this taking place in these cells that are going to kill the bacteria, but some of them are coming in and they're saying, I think there's a conspiracy going on among those bacteria. We better mount that. So the Secret Service, the plasma cells and the lymphocytes, they're saying we need to produce a systemic of onslaught against this, and they start to produce the antibodies. And so it takes usually 10 days for an antibody to be produced from not having any antibodies before. 10 days to maybe 2 weeks. That's why if you get influenza and you haven't had that flu bug at all, the illness usually lasts a week to 10 days. And as the antibodies start to rise, so you feel better. I had an infection in my throat the other day. I looked in my throat. I shouldn't do this, but I doctor myself sometimes. And I looked and I said, oh, grief. I must have a Coxsackie A virus. I could see the little vesicles on the back of my throat. My wife's saying, take antibiotic. I said, no, it's a viral infection. She said, well, you don't look very good. I said, I don't feel very good. I'm not going to go to the office. I don't want to spread this around the office. She said, but why aren't you taking any medicine? I said, because I'll be better in 7 days. She said, "What? Well, how do you know you're going to be better?" I said, it's a viral infection. You watch. And sure enough, you know, on about 5 days, I said, I think I'm feeling a little bit better. On the sixth day, she said, oh, you're looking and feeling a lot better. On the seventh day, I said, you know, I'm going to go back to the office. I don't think I'm infectious anymore. I'd already got my antibodies, and I was feeling good. It's the process of immunity. Now, the phagocytosis, I've talked about it, and we won't move. It's selective. It doesn't eat everything. It only eats those that are recognized as foreigners. This process of recognizing what is self and what is not self is something that takes place in the embryo. The thymic gland, a newborn is born with a big thymus here. If you take an x-ray of a baby, you sometimes think, wow, they've got some big tumor. Well, if you're a pediatrician, you've been taught that's the thymus. And it shrinks over time. But the thymus has marked out this is normal. There is a phase. There is a phase in the development of the embryo that it doesn't recognize the difference between itself and something else. So that actually there is the possibility that we could take another cell strain and put it into the embryo and it would grow there and the body would then have two strains of self. We talk about somebody who is a mosaic. They have two lines of cells and or a chimera, twins. Often have exchanged some of those cells very early, and they will carry genetic material from the other one. So this ability to recognize self and non-self, it takes place about 4 or 5 months in the embryonic development and the fetal development that we recognize this. But by the time we're born, we know what is us and we know what is not us. And this is a very important thing. Now, we call this macrophage and the monocyte system, the whole of the system, the reticular endothelial system. The spleen, which sits about here in our body, is a major, major filter and clearer of bacteria. It is the major organ of the reticular endothelial system. Not only does it clean up bacteria, it cleans up red blood cells. If cells are getting too old, they're starting to be fragmented, their surface is not good, they're irregular, they're not smooth anymore, they start to recognize this cell is dying. The spleen is the cemetery for that, and it will take care of it, cleans it up, and then it passes along those products, along the portal system, to the liver, and the liver takes those broken down products and makes bilirubin and biliverdin, which are the color of bile. So when we see the bile, and we see the yellow and the red color. Thank you so much. And we see the colors of the bile. We know that the spleen has sent it along to the liver. Now the liver is very careful. They are very good. They recycle. They say, hey, we take out that iron. We don't want that iron. We'll take out that globin. We want that globin because that's protein. We'll reprocess that. The body recycles the stuff, but the biliverdin and the bilirubin, it says, no, we don't. It lets that go out and actually puts them into bile salts and things like that. And they actually help with digestion of fats. So everything's put to good use. What a beautiful, beautiful system. So when somebody comes along and says, you got to have an enema every day, you know, you start to think, you know, really, how much do they know about the beauty of creation? How much do they understand how fantastically made we have been? So the white blood cells, I've told you about them, how they work and release these chemicals. I've simplified it for you. It's in your book, and it goes through. Now, eosinophils play an important role in killing parasites. It seems that they can actually control even worms. I had a missionary come to Africa. He was a wonderful missionary. He did fantastic work. He organized a whole village for the people who had leprosy and were handicapped. He had them doing handicrafts out there in Yuka. It was a most wonderful thing. But he used to want to swim in the river. I said to him, man, you mustn't swim in the rivers here. These rivers have snails in there, and those snails, they are an intermediary host for schistosomiasis, and you'll get schistosomiasis. Nah, he was an Australian. We do water skiing in the water. We ski so fast, man. If you should see us skiing over the water, we just ski. Those parasites, they'll never be able to get us. Unfortunately, 18 months later, we had to send him back to Australia extremely ill because the parasites had invaded his bladder and they were closing off his ureter, and he had them in his bowel. But those parasites, if you didn't get too heavy a dose, the eosinophils will surround those cells. But what happened was those parasites come in through your skin, work their way through your blood, go to the bowel and to the bladder, and then the male worm and the female worm copulate, and she lays all the eggs, and the eggs migrate into the bowel or into the bladder, and then the eggs go into the water, and then as they mature in the water, they attack the snail, and they go through the snail, and finally the snail excretes another form of the parasite, and that's the one that can go through the skin. I mean, it's a fierce world out there. And so this is happening, but the eosinophils will surround those baby larvae and kill them and kill many of them, but not able to contain the whole thing. So eosinophils, very important for protecting us against parasites. Basophils release heparin, a substance that makes it so the blood doesn't clot and allows the flow of the blood into these inflamed areas. They release bradykinin, serotonin, myriads of chemicals that are doing their part in this. Now, we do have the innate immunity, which we've talked about, and I'm not going to spend a lot of time. We talked about skin and hair in our ears and up our nose and spiders up our nose and all this kind of thing. There is this type of basic immune protection, but it's not truly immunity in the way that we are doing it. Now, acquired immunity, as opposed to immunity that is passive, maybe when we were born we get some antibodies from our mother, and so for the first 6 months of our life we are protected against diseases she has fought off. Now what we find is we are going to acquire our own. As a pediatrician, I saw several cases of a disease called Bruton's syndrome or disease. Bruton's was a very interesting disease. It was a disease that was caused by an immunological problem. They could not produce antibodies. And these kids were exactly like people who we see with AIDS today. But theirs was not an acquired deficiency. Theirs was an immune deficiency. And we'll talk about, after lunch, we'll talk about HIV deficiency. But we acquire immunity by those cells that I've just described being able to do their work. It's specific. It's so specific that if we can identify clearly what the antigen is, you got me now? Everybody with me? If we can take the antigen and make it very clear, we can induce a specific targeted antibody response against that antigen. So let's take polio, for example. There are about three strains of polio virus, three different strains. By looking at the polio, they were able to selectively find out what parts of the polio were stimulatory of the antibodies. And so they were able to then put those together and give those to an individual as an injection. Now, in the early days, they started using live viruses. And sometimes there would be an outbreak of paralytic polio in response to the vaccine. And of course, that caused everybody who was against vaccines to say, oh, you mustn't give the vaccines. A great aunt, she had it, and she got the disease. Usually they were tamed ones if they were alive. But they then moved to the killed vaccine, where they were using now the elements, the parts of the coat. So, for instance, what we would do if we were wanting to immunize somebody, we might take the photograph of your face and circulate the photograph in the body so that when the real person, you, came along, or your face came along, they say, we've seen that photograph before, we recognize him. See? And so you would come in and they would arrest you immediately because the wanted posters were all around everywhere. So immunization is taking the antigen, which is similar to, it may be parts of it the same as you, but it's like your photograph, but putting that into the body, and the body now recognizes the real thing when the real thing comes along. So you got that? It may be like saying, yes. It is in the lymphocyte and the plasma cells. And it is in the family of the lymphocyte and plasma cells that once they have switched on and taken that and written it into their nuclear membrane, we must produce this particular type of protein. Think of the complexity of this. I mean, this is phenomenal, man. They've taken the photograph and they've taken the image, then they've done a reverse image. When we talk about AIDS, it's going to blow your mind too. And so what they have done, they now are producing a protein substance that will bind only to your face. It won't bind to my face. It doesn't bind to her face. It knows your face, you see? Because we've taken your picture and put wanted on your picture. Now, maybe sometime you come along and infect them. and it takes a photograph of your face. And it maybe takes 7 or 8 days for it to be able to fight off the infection that your face is causing in the body. But once it's got it and got your number, it does you off. But, you know, along comes your clone, which is the virus, a year, 2 years later. No way it's going to work because it's already met you. Now, either you get the disease, or we, as doctors say, we know this family. This guy didn't infect any of you guys, but he has the potential to. Click, we got your photograph. We take your photograph and we inject your photograph into everybody, and people now know, they say, wanted. We got that guy. And when you come along and try to infect us, they say, you're wanted. And they kill it, you see? That's how it works. Yeah. Yeah. No, they divide, see? They divide. They make more of themselves. And they produce progeny. And the memory is passed on to the progeny. See? So the memory goes to the progeny. It just keeps putting it. Now, actually, some of these protections don't last forever. Let's take chickenpox. See, chickenpox, I had chickenpox when I was about, I don't know, 8 or 9 years old. All right? I've got a little mark somewhere. You can find it. Yeah. Chickenpox. Varicella.
Varicella.
Cella. Yeah, cella. Chickenpox. Okay? Varicella, yeah, varicella. And so you get the little blisters and then they scab and you pull the scab off and you get the little scar and, you know, but as you get older, that virus has not been actually killed. That virus has been subdued. That virus has been controlled. That virus has been pushed down. So it is run like the Philistines before the children of Israel to the mountains, you see. And it's hidden itself, and it hides itself within the protection of nerve cells. And it sits there quietly, you know, just like sin sits there quietly, waiting for its occasion. Oh, it's not going to speak out in the church today because it knows it might be thrown away. But it wants to sit there, and there's just a little bit nurtured, and it sits there in our soul. And then when the antibodies, as we get older and older, and our antibody levels fall, then the virus says, aha! And it comes out, this time it comes out as shingles, herpes zoster. It's the same virus that caused chickenpox in us when we were kids, you see. But our immune system, as we're getting older, isn't so strong to suppress it. That's why they've got a vaccine for shingles. And they say, you know, if you're 55 or so, you might do well to take a shingles vaccine, or it's the same virus, it's the virus, and boost your immunity so you don't come down with shingles. Will it protect you 100%? No, because, you see, the antibodies aren't 100% in eradicating those. They're only able to suppress it. So that's why sometimes vaccine doesn't give you 100% protection, because it depends on how effective the body is in able to eradicate that virus. And we can't eradicate, we don't seem to eradicate the virus of chickenpox totally. You got the picture?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, question.
I never had chickenpox.
You never had chickenpox? Well, now let's look at that. Is it possible? There are several possibilities. Number one, you may never have met the chickenpox virus when you were a kid. And as you got older, you just weren't exposed to enough. And yes, it's possible. There are people can live and not meet these particular viruses. Number two, it is possible that you had chickenpox, but your immune system was so good that it really never manifested itself as a full-blown disease. And you had one or two little spots, they didn't even know you'd had it. So they said, you said, I never had chickenpox. But you had a subclinical infection of chickenpox. That's another possibility. Yeah. But let me give you another one. A third possibility is that sometimes you received a chickenpox vaccine. Now, the vaccine is not the real virus. It is the photograph of the virus, all right, the wanted poster that's been injected into you. So your body may then have had some chickenpox come along, but it eradicated it before it could cause chickenpox. Now, if you have had the real virus, you could be at risk for shingles. But if you had the vaccine was not live, see? The vaccine is not going to lurk in your nerve system and cause you to have, you see, it's not going to be the real thing. It's the photograph. So this is how the immunization program works. Now, we do well to remember how it all happened. William Jenner is the man that first started this whole process of vaccination. Why do we call it vaccination? Because it comes from vaca. What's a vaca?
A cow.
The vaca, all right? Yeah. No, not the sheep. This is a vaccination. He noted that smallpox, which was a very common disease, was not seen in the milkmaids as frequently, who had their three little-legged stools and were sitting down with their head into the flank of the cow, and they were milking the cows. Because cows sometimes got a disease called cowpox. And so the milkmaids might get cowpox. They might have a sore. It wasn't spread through the whole body. It would just be maybe one sore, and it would last for 10 days. And then they didn't ever have it again. But they had a history of acquiring the cowpox virus. It takes observational skills. It takes putting two and two together. And William Jenner said, these milkmaids, they get cowpox, and then they don't seem to ever get smallpox. I wonder if there's a cross relationship between the cowpox virus and the smallpox virus. So he took some of the cowpox virus and scratched it of the pus from the cowpox sores and put it into himself. And he got a sore there. A sore came. Woo. And then he exposed himself to people with smallpox. He never got it. So he started to say, wow, I think, let's try this. And so they started giving cowpox virus to people. And that's why we said he vaccinated them. He took vaccinia virus, which was the virus that caused cowpox, and he put it in himself. And you know, somewhere on my arm, when I was a kid, see up here, the scar? They did the same to me. They scratched in some vaccinia or cowpox into my arm, and I did get a sore there. But I never got smallpox, and neither did anybody else who was vaccinated. And today, smallpox is an extinct disease. There are only samples of the original virus kept in three laboratories in the world. Only three laboratories in the world, one in Russia, one in America, one in Britain, have samples of the original smallpox virus. Now, of course, we were talking about biological warfare. We've now come to the point that we don't feel it's necessary to immunize against smallpox because there is no smallpox. And very occasionally, somebody got this and scratched themselves. They had an immune deficiency, and pretty soon it looked like they'd got smallpox from the vaccine. One in maybe 10,000 or 20,000 people. So we didn't give vaccine to people with eczema, for example. We said, no, you don't. We won't give it to you because it could spread over your body. That was not smallpox, that was vaccinia. But we eradicated a disease with vaccination. Today, outbreaks of measles, outbreaks of polio, they are only found in small clusters in people in nations and areas where the immunization program has not been successful. So I hope you understand that there is a difference between the vaccine, which is the wanted poster, and the real thug, see? But many people believe that vaccination is the process of putting the criminals in our body. It's really putting the wanted posters in our body, not the real criminals. I think I'm going to finish here. and answer any questions that you might have. Yes. Hepatitis is not one disease. Hepatitis means inflammation, itis means inflammation of the liver. And there are several viruses that cause hepatitis. The commonest one is hepatitis A. That was found because of contaminated water, contaminated foodstuffs, where the virus would be on the food. Hepatitis B is transmitted more likely in blood. So blood can spread it, or sexually transmitted can be spread by sexual transmission. So hepatitis B is one that can be spread. Hepatitis C is similar to, in its spread, to hepatitis B. And then there are things like hepatitis G, hepatitis H, rare forms of hepatitis. Elder Kress, traveling in all around the world, he died of, I believe it was a hepatitis G, which is an unusual, very rare form of hepatitis. We have a vaccine against hepatitis A and against hepatitis B. Now, many mothers carry the virus hepatitis A. In the immune system against hepatitis B, sometimes the body can eradicate the hepatitis B. Sometimes it doesn't eradicate it. Sometimes it suppresses it, like the chickenpox story. Now, when it's just suppressed it, the person doesn't have clinical disease, but carries in their blood hepatitis antigen still, the hepatitis B antigen. Their babies can get infected. And so we immunize babies born to mothers who are hepatitis B antigen positive at birth, so that they don't get it through the breast milk, and they don't get it from the mother, hopefully, if they haven't already got it. We want to build immunization. But because we never know that the hepatitis virus, be it A, B, C, has been totally eradicated, we will not take blood from a person who has had hepatitis. So I've had hepatitis. As a child, I had hepatitis, probably hepatitis A. And that will net my blood, they will not receive it and take it. Although, if it was an absolute life and death situation and somebody was going to die, and we were no, then we would give my blood. I would willingly give my blood, but we wouldn't give it under normal circumstances, because it's a common sort of blood anyhow. I'm a mongrel type of person. I'm an O positive. There's lots of people O positive who didn't have hepatitis. So why would we take the risk for somebody if we could just get that kind of blood? See? So you understand a little bit maybe now about immunization, about the immune system. We will talk a little bit more about HIV and AIDS after lunch. Yes. There is a whole family of diseases called autoimmune diseases. Auto means self. Automatic, self. And this comes from a problem where that recognition of what is self and what is not self has fallen apart. When that takes place, the body starts to target itself. So, for instance, in diabetes, type 1 diabetes, the body makes antibodies against those insulin-producing cells, the beta cells of Langerhans in the pancreas, and it kills them off. So having killed the cells that make the insulin, the person is now a diabetic, has no insulin. And this is another reason why we say, be careful in your health ministry. We can't cure all kinds of diabetes with diet and exercise and doing those kind of things. So don't become just so radical that everything is black and white. There's lots of gray in between. And so we want you to be very, very judicious and gentle in the way you deal with people, because maybe by going through this course you will understand that things may be more complex than sometimes we portray them in health ministries.
This media was produced by Audioverse for the NAD Health Summit. If you would like to learn more about the NAD Health Summit, please visit www.nadhealthsummit.com. Or if you would like to listen to more free online sermons, please visit www.audioverse.org.